Well, I didn't keep track of the exact number of expletives he used, Siobhan. Okay, I'm not a fuckometer.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Sweet Smell of Succession, an unofficial recap podcast about the HBO original series Succession. I'm David Chen. I'm the host of podcasts such as The Filmcast and Culturally Relevant. Joining me today, as always, she's the co-host of podcasts such as Extra Hot Great, Listen to Sassy, and Again With This. Tara Ariano, how is the Roy family doing this week, Tara?
They're great.
You know, mixed bag.
Yeah.
You know, it's not all bad.
Yeah.
But it's pretty bad. Okay. Well, if you're just tuning in for the first time, which is very possible, what we do here on this podcast is we recap and spoil everything that happened in this week's episode of Succession. This week, we'll be talking about season 3, episode 9, All the Bells Say. All the Bells Say, Season 3, Episode 9. We'll be spoiling everything. And you can find more episodes of this podcast at successionpodcast.com. Email us at successionpodcast@gmail.com. This will be our last episode this season, it looks like. And as we kick this off, I do just want to say thank you to Tara for going on this little journey with me. I really appreciate it, Tara. And I think everyone who listens agrees that Tara has brought it every week. Whatever it is, Tara has brought it. And so I'm very grateful for that, Tara.
Thank you. And I feel the same about you.
I think we got an email this week from somebody that was like, you're the only, you know, Succession recap podcast worth listening to as far as I'm concerned.
Oh.
And that felt nice. So
that's very nice.
But the other thing before we kick this off that I want to say is, well, just that there's a ton of follow-up from last week. There's a ton of stuff that has happened in the last week that I just feel like we have to get to. So let's talk about some of the quick things first. There's a bunch of like quick little things I just want to mention. Last week in our recap of season 3, episode 8, I made a point about saying how, hey, I thought the show did a pretty good job of simulating what it's like to accidentally sext someone using iOS. Because my belief was that they had done a good job of accurately depicting how iOS works. But my friend and colleague David Ferrier, who writes the newsletter Webworm, which you can find on Substack, wrote an article entitled, Is It Possible to Actually Send Your Dick Pic to Your Significant Other, like in Last Night's Succession? And he actually tried to replicate what happened in the show and was unable to. So it doesn't actually work like that. And so therefore I was completely wrong, but they depicted it plausibly nonetheless. However, I do want to eat crow on that one. And sorry if I led many to believe that it was possible to accidentally sext people in that way.
I thought they went to like real contortions to make that a problem that they didn't need to. I accidentally texted my dad earlier today when I meant to text you. Fortunately, nothing scandalous to either of you, but just because I was in the wrong, like in the wrong window in iMessage on my desktop. Like it happens. People make mistakes.
It happens. Just not precisely in quite the way that it was depicted in the show. But
right.
Yes, I agree that it does happen. So. We also got a few tweets and emails from folks calling out the fact that in season 3, episode 1, Kendall says something along the lines of like, hey, I want to get some BoJack guys to write my tweets. And many people pointed out that in the Netflix original series, BoJack Horseman, I guess you could call this a spoiler about BoJack Horseman. So if you haven't seen BoJack Horseman, skip ahead by 30 seconds. But in the Netflix original series, BoJack Horseman, there is also a washed up rich person who almost drowns in a pool. And I don't know if that's an intentional reference or not. I don't know if Jesse Armstrong is a big BoJack fan, but I assume someone on staff was. Otherwise, why did they put that reference in there? But I did think the parallels were interesting. And also, again, spoilers for BoJack Horseman, but he doesn't actually die in the pool in BoJack Horseman either. So when I saw that connection, I was like, you know, I don't think Kendall's dying. And on that note, I'm very proud of us, Tara. I'm very proud of us because I think you completely nailed it in terms of how the show would handle Kendall almost dying last episode, right? Like, as far as I can recall.
No, I mean, he does go to the hospital.
He does go to the hospital.
I didn't think it would even get that far.
So I interpreted your words differently and more charitably than you. You know, I interpreted it as you saying, we're not going to see, we as viewers will not see the inside of a hospital. That was kind of what I interpreted.
Yes.
Now, maybe you meant to say the character will never be in the hospital, in which case, I guess you're a little bit wrong there. But I think you and I both treated this subject with the appropriate amount of reverence and time and energy that it deserved last week on the podcast, which is to say we talked about it for 10, 15 minutes. We reflected on and deliberated over like whether or not this would be a good idea and whether the show would actually do this. And then we moved on. What I have seen is like literally I've read probably half a dozen articles on websites being like, is Kendall dead? And like speculating about whether he's dead. And some people saying for sure he is dead. Like so some people 100% convinced he is dead. And I think you and I both felt that that's probably not going to happen. And we were right about that. So I just want to say, I don't usually have many successes in life, you know, but, this is one where I felt like we didn't like 100% nail it, but we got like pretty close, I think pretty close. Yeah. So, okay. Anyway, enough gloating about that one. Some people actually were speculating. We got a couple emails about this that like, on that subject, that Kendall at the end of last episode, there's a lot of questions about what he's actually doing, and some people actually speculated maybe he's like pretending to be dead. You know what I mean? Like, kind of wanting to see what it's like to drown because his father gave him that speech early in the episode.
Right, right.
That was a great theory, but I think this episode seems to remove all doubt that was not the case as far as we can tell. Like he actually was intoxicated or drunk, and he actually accidentally fell into the pool, right? Is what we're led to believe in this episode, I think.
Yes.
So wanted to make reference to those theories as well. And then finally, I wanted to mention the fact that this episode, you know, Tara usually regales us every week with a extremely intricate and detailed and with, you know, witty jokes and everything in there. And there's going to be some of that in tonight's recap podcast, but this is the only episode of this season for which you were not supplied the episode in advance of it airing.
Yes.
So we just finished watching the episode like an hour ago, mm-hmm. and you like I said, hey Tara, like put together kind of like a rough outline for this one, right? Since we're not going to have like a lot of time. And of course, Tara generates like basically like 80% of what she would have generated otherwise in terms of its level of detail. So, but just wanted to say if we sound a little bit more harried and flustered than usual, and there's not going to be many clips in this episode, it's because we want to get this out to you as quickly as possible. And Tara did not get the episode in advance. So,
yes.
But Tara, all that is preamble for the biggest finale story of the week, which of course is Jeremy Strong's profile in The New Yorker.
Yeah.
Now, this was a profile that went viral last week because it's an extraordinary profile and everyone needs to go read it. I think just as a profile, it's a really entertaining read. And there has been a lot of response and blowback to the profile, which I would like to discuss with you before we get mm-hmm. into the episode.
Yeah.
But first, let's start with this. What were your general impressions of this New Yorker profile? Which, like, in general, I think the broad strokes are that it paints Jeremy Strong as a difficult to work with person. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, like, what you thought overall of the profile.
It's great. This is the kind of profile that you don't see that much anymore. And there's been, over the past, not even recently, like, over the past maybe 10 or 15 years, there's been a trend of, like, letting celebrity profiles be written by other celebrities who are friends of the celebrity. Mm-hmm. Like, because, you know, sometimes that's the only way a magazine can get someone to be in it. If they're like, I don't want a real journalist to talk to me. I just want, I want someone really friendly who's going to respect all of the, you know, areas I don't want to talk about. And we really need outlets like The New Yorker, and there are fewer and fewer of them. I mean, there's a line in this episode about how, like, you know, media companies are on the decline, and certainly Condé Nast, which owns The New Yorker, is one of those. But when something like this comes along, you realize, like, oh, this is what celebrity journalism is supposed to be, because we see it so seldom anymore. Mm-hmm. But this was a real journalist who, like, traveled with the subject in several different cities and countries, even talked to everyone that he could talk to, like a former high school classmate, happens to be Chris Evans, who is also an actor now, but still
never
a guy he went to high school with. Yeah, it just it gets everywhere. And because it is so candid about what people were saying about him, some of which was, you know, not flattering on the record, and a lot of it was not flattering off the record. There's been a lot of blowback from it. So before we get to the blowback, though, what did you think?
I mean, he's basically portrayed in the profile as really difficult to work with, as somebody who kind of embodies the character of Kendall Roy in many ways. Jeremy Strong has just had a very fascinating career. I mean, sorry, I'm a little bit all over the place, but basically there are several amazing lines in this profile that I'm not going to read to you. Okay. So one of them is, for a while, Jeremy Strong lived in the Hollywood Hills, where driving home on Sunset Boulevard, he would pass a billboard that read, "What the Shrek just happened?" He was 31 and asking himself the same question. So that's amazing. And what was also amazing was that Jeremy Strong seems to have a confusion that you and I had when we, or not you and I, you and I had a difference of opinion about this, about whether or not Succession was a comedy.
Right.
And so this paragraph, every sentence of this paragraph that I'm about to read is incredible. Okay, so, quote, "When I ask Jeremy Strong about the rap that Kendall performs in season two at a gala for his father, a top contender for Kendall's most cringeworthy moment, he gave an unsmiling answer about Raskolnikov, referencing Kendall's monstrous pain." That's about the L to the OG rap, by the way. Raskolnikov, referencing Kendall's monstrous pain. Okay. Kieran Culkin told me, after the first season, he said something to me like, "I'm worried that people might think that the show is a comedy." And I said, "I think the show is a comedy." He thought I was kidding. Part of the appeal of Succession is its amalgam of drama and bone-dry satire. When I told Strong that I, too, thought of the show as a dark comedy, he looked at me with incomprehension and asked, "In the sense that, like, Chekhov is a comedy?" "No," I said, "in the sense that it's funny." "That's exactly why we cast Jeremy in that role," McKay told me, "because he's not playing it like a comedy. He's playing it like he's Hamlet," end quote. Mm-hmm. That's Adam McKay, who is one of the executive producers.
Yeah.
And the kind of meta story of the profile also sent a lot of tongues wagging as well, I think, because I think a lot of people, like, I saw people who, you know, I greatly admire and read all the work all the time, like Willa Paskin and Alan Sepinwall, were kind of speculating, like, okay, there's no way New Yorker would have run this story unless Kendall's dead, right? Because you have his coworkers on the record as saying negative things about him.
Yeah.
I personally did not feel that anything the coworker said was really off the mark. Like, it all felt quite reasonable to me, what was said in the profile. But yeah, some people were like, some people felt like, you know, Kieran Culkin and Brian Cox's quotes were basically, so to speak, shivving Kendall or Jeremy Strong in this profile.
Yeah.
I thought it was very reasonable. What did you think of their
quotes?
I didn't think any.
I agree with you. I didn't think anything they said. I mean, I could see that argument. Like,
yes.
I think Allison Herman from The Ringer said it too, and I could see it. But I also don't. Neither Cox nor Culkin strikes me as the kind of person who wouldn't have said these things
exactly
to Jeremy Strong's face.
They just, they DGAF at this point in their career, right? Like, they,
yeah,
I think they're fine. Like, they're going to be fine. And so that never struck me as particularly like a big worry about that. But Willa Paskin on Twitter brought up this possibility that, like, if Kendall was dead, then the profile probably wouldn't have been written and published like this, right?
Mm-hmm.
It probably would have been about Jeremy Strong saying goodbye to this character.
Right.
And so, you know, maybe there's a possibility that the writer of this profile, Michael Shulman, didn't know what happens to Kendall, and they wrote this and published this profile anyway, but that it just felt very, very unlikely that they wouldn't have structured it like, you know, Jeremy Strong says goodbye to the role that made him a star kind of deal. You know, like, mm-hmm, that would have been the meta story and not just Jeremy Strong is kind of a difficult person.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, which actually, as it turns out, probably was a great point about this, right? Like, Kendall ended up not dying. And so, you know, the profile still stands on its own.
Yeah.
But let's talk a little bit about the reaction to this, right?
Yeah.
So in the days since that, so like I would say a good 5 days after this profile was published, Aaron Sorkin writes a letter to Jessica Chastain, and then Jessica Chastain tweets out, quote, Aaron Sorkin doesn't have social media, so he asked me to post this letter on his behalf.
Okay, well, first of all, she was the first one to take to Twitter and say,
okay,
I've worked with him twice, he's great, everyone leave Jeremy Strong alone.
Yes, fair enough, fair and enough. So Kate, I don't want to get the timeline wrong. Go ahead.
Right, Kate Arthur from Variety was like, did you read this profile? And her answer was something like, I read profiles when I can, so no. was my interpretation of that answer. I might be getting the details wrong, but that's how it sounded.
Who's to say whether or not a profile has been read or not? Who defines what read means in our society?
Anyway, Jessica Chastain has a history of showing her ass on social media. So that's one example. But anyway, she was the first out of the gate to be like, I've worked with him twice and he's great. So back
now, on. Here's the thing about this Aaron Sorkin letter, right? Mm-hmm. It is incredibly ill-advised. Like, I think he should not have done it because it makes Aaron Sorkin look like who he probably is, which is a humorless, you know, dull, you know, like a guy who doesn't get social media because he doesn't have it, obviously, and just has no sense of humor and takes himself too seriously, which
the perfect person to be directing a movie about a legendary comedian that's coming out next week.
Oh, yes. No, for sure. There is this idea, like Aaron Sorkin sending this letter to Jessica Chastain to publish on her Twitter drew far more attention to the profile than it otherwise would have had.
Absolutely.
Right? Like so many people would never have read the profile unless Aaron Sorkin wrote this letter. Okay. However, and I hate myself for what I'm about to say, Tara, but I think Aaron Sorkin has in this letter a mild point, which is, Aaron Sorkin's contributions to the profile were kind of done a little bit dirty, I think. Like, Michael Shulman asked him a bunch of questions, Aaron Sorkin wrote a bunch of questions, and then the profile kind of framed Aaron Sorkin's contributions to the profile in, like, a very unflattering light, in my opinion. So, basically, I'm saying I could totally understand why Aaron Sorkin felt the need to kind of defend his honor and Jeremy Strong's honor. I think he went about it in the completely wrong way, and he probably shouldn't have done it this way. But, you know, I do feel like I understand why Aaron Sorkin was a little bit outraged, and that's as much sympathy as I'm going to give him. But then, I know you probably disagree vehemently. So go ahead.
No, I mean, I agree with you that that responding this way drew more attention to the profile, of course. But the other thing is that, like, the main thing that he's quoted about is Jeremy Strong asking to be tear gassed on the set of the trial of the Chicago 7, which is a story that's already been reported. Like, I had already heard that before. This is not new news.
Yeah, I know. But the profile frames it like it's Aaron Sorkin is talking smack about Jeremy Strong. You know what I mean? And I can understand if a reporter came to me and they're like, give me some quotes about Tara Ariano, and I gave them 5 thoughtful quotes and a couple joking asides, and then they used the joking asides in a way that made it sound like I was, like, you know, besmirching you, like, and that would get me pissed off. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
So, but anyway, the next day, I think Anne Hathaway also Instagrammed about, like, she worked with Jeremy Strong on Serenity, classic movie. So, you know, and she's like, he's awesome. And so, like, yours and mine pet theory, Tara, is that Jeremy Strong and or his PR team orchestrated this in some way. Is that fair to say about how you and I feel about this?
I didn't think that until I read the profile. And then it was like, oh, clearly, yes, this is what happened, because it really paints a portrait of him as, like, such a calculated striver in his career.
Mm-hmm.
And so my impression of him before was like, oh no, he's like this ethereal sort of, you know, he's above it all. He doesn't have his own social media or whatever. He wouldn't do this. They're just doing it on his behalf because they love him so much, which, you know, great. But then after reading it, it was like, oh no, he's thinking about this shit all the time. So if that were the case, of course, we cannot possibly know. But based on the portrait that comes out in the profile, that does seem like it's possible.
Yeah.
But the other thing to consider is that, like, actors are such narcissists. Like, part of it may just be like, if Jessica Chastain is the subject of a profile like this in a year, that she would want Jeremy Strong to come to her defense in the same way, you know? Like,
yeah.
I was just thinking today about all the actors who were like, oh, I wish I had a reason to weigh in on this Jeremy Strong discourse and be like, I stand with Jeremy Strong as well, but I never worked with him, so I don't have any reason to.
Well, I have a few more things to say about this, but let's take a quick break to thank a sponsor, and then we'll be right back.
The Sweet Smell of Succession is brought to you in part by Quip. Between cocktails, party games, and going all in on candy cane season, your mouth goes through a lot this time of year. Give it the gift of better oral care with Quip. The Quip electric toothbrush is loved by over 7 million mouths and has timed sonic vibrations with 30-second pulses to guide a dentist-recommended 2-minute clean, a lightweight and sleek design for adults and kids with no wires or bulky charger to weigh you down, and reusable handles in a range of sleek metal hues, including best-selling all black and all pink, as well as bright plastic colors sure to make a pop to your bathroom counter. In addition to brush heads, Quip also delivers fresh floss, toothpaste, mouthwash, and gum refills every 3 months from $5. Shipping is free, so you can save money and skip the hustle and bustle of shopping in store during the holidays. Even more good news, Quip is running their best deals of the year, which means you won't be paying through the teeth when you gift better oral health to everyone on your list. If you go to getquip.com/succession right now, on top of their holiday savings, you'll get your first refill free. That's your first refill free and up to 40% off bundles at getquip.com/succession. That's getquip.com/succession. Quip, the good habits company.
So I want to say that, I mean, imagine what went into the posting of these statements, right? Like, at the very least, if Jeremy Strong was not behind them, or Jeremy Strong's team was not behind them, at the very least, they had to clear it with him. Like, it, you know, if a profile comes out that's negative about Tara Ariano, and Tara's like really unhappy with this New Yorker profile that was written about her, and I'm like, you know what? Fuck the New Yorker. I'm going to defend Tara. I would check in with Tara about that. I'm not going to just go out on social media without checking with Tara. Like, Tara, do you mind if I'm going to say this thing? Okay. Are you okay with this? Is it going to help you more than hurt you? You know, like, I would check in with you. So at the very least, all these people are checking in with Jeremy Strong. And the fact that all these like statements are coming out in quick succession makes me feel like, so to speak, makes me feel like it was orchestrated in some way.
Is there a profile of me coming out that you've been interviewed for? Because you've used this example more than once. Now I'm worried.
Who's to say? Who's to say? I may have given some statements on background. I'm sorry, Tara.
No!
So that's kind of why. Like, there had to be some kind of coordination. And who? What was the causal link in the coordination? I don't know. But it does feel plausible that it was Jeremy doing it. But the more troubling implication of all this, which you've pointed out beautifully, is that celebrities basically want a future in which they control everything that gets said about them. Right?
Yeah, and it's easier than it used to be for them to do that. Like, completely. With social media, they generally can control their own, you know, narrative in that way.
Yeah, and when you see celebrities coming out like this, I mean, yes, I think the piece, you know, used Aaron Sorkin quotes selectively, but overall, It's a rollicking good read. It is insightful about Strong's process, and I don't think it's particularly insulting to Strong. Like, it shows him as difficult, which it sounds like he actually is.
Yeah.
And so it feels like rather truthful. And I think the fact that people are interpreting it as a hit job is them kind of like telling on themselves. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yes.
It's kind of like even the most minor affront. The most minor thing that could even be perceived as an affront, we are going to strike back at this with so much force, the collective might of our social media force, in a way that feels disproportionate compared to all the other things that have happened in the last year and a half. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So it just feels like a little bit chilling in a minor way, because the whole thing is so silly on its face. But on some level, it's a little bit chilling that all these celebrities are like, how dare you write honestly about one of us? Kind of, you know?
Yes. And especially coming for the New Yorker, which is like famously one of the most fact-checked publications in existence.
I agree. So that is kind of dismaying. And so everything we just talked about, all that stuff happened in the time since our last podcast episode, right? So there's a lot that happened, and I just we needed to get into it because it's impossible to really talk about Succession without all that stuff.
I mean, and it's the, it's our last chance to do it before the season is over.
Okay, so that's all the preamble to the main episode. Anything else, Tara, I missed? I think I caught everything, right?
No, I mean, I put a couple more links in there, but there truly is just not, it's not possible to keep up with all of the Succession discourse that there is.
Indeed. Okay. Well, the other thing I want to mention also is, I think you texted this to me after we recorded last week, was that J. Smith Cameron, who plays Jerry on the show, gave an interview to a radio show or a podcast where she said something very upsetting happens.
It was Watch What Happens Live.
Watch What Happens Live. Something very upsetting happens in the finale. So that is something she said. Then Adam McKay in this Jeremy Strong profile said, like, he's playing it like Hamlet. We all know what happens to Hamlet.
Yeah.
And so I think that all those like disparate tea leaves sent the internet completely spinning into overdrive about whether or not Kendall would actually be alive in this episode.
Yes.
And so at the end of the day, he is alive. It's just completely fine. But let's start with this, Tara. What did you think overall about the season 3 finale of Succession?
It was overlong. I mean, I'm on the record as saying I haven't loved this season. Mm-hmm. So with that said, I'm glad it was only 9 episodes instead of 10, because I don't know how else they would have padded this out. But I don't think anything happened in it that was not earned or set up over the course of it. What did you think?
I think overall it's really a strong episode, and there are some huge disappointments I have that we'll get to. But what is great about this episode is the acting, primarily. Every single major character gets like a really meaningful beat in this episode, and they all get their moment to shine. And I think that's really lovely. Mm-hmm. In particular, the final scene, right? And it's kind of a series of these big play-like scenes of dialogue and people shouting at each other.
Yeah.
And the final sequence is, in my opinion, like pretty gut-wrenching. And a lot of interesting stuff happens there. And Brian Cox does an amazing job. And Sarah Snook and, you know, basically everyone has a really amazing moment. But I think that what this episode really delivers on for me are two plot lines that have been running through this season in the background, and it pays them off in such a lovely way. But that's specifically the Tom storyline and the Roman storyline. Mm-hmm. Like, those two storylines, I feel this season really delivered on. Now, I have different thoughts about the Kendall storyline, and there's a bunch of storylines that the show introduced that were never paid off, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's a problem. And who knows why they were never paid off? Maybe it was COVID. Maybe it was other reasons, production realities, incompetence in storytelling. Who knows? But overall, I think that there was enough good stuff in this episode to make me feel like it was a really strong episode. I would agree with you that out of the 3 seasons of the show, this one is probably the weakest. Mm-hmm. And I think that this finale of the 3 finales is also probably the weakest, but those are some really good finales in season 1 and 2.
I agree.
And so I think this one was pretty good, and there were moments of it that were transcendent, and there was stuff in it that was kind of bad. So let's get into it. So
right.
What happens in this episode, Tara?
Well, you already said Kendall is alive, and the first shot is Logan reading to Iverson from a little kid's book that at almost the exact same moment, Logan and I are both like, isn't this book a little young for you? And Sophie says, no, it comforts him. He likes to hear from it. So Logan, Kendall's not in the scene, but Logan says, like, your dad is okay. He's okay. It's fine. So that's how we find out that Kendall's alive.
Yeah.
So officially the story is that he just fell off the floaty, but even following that premise through doesn't make him look completely healthy mentally, because it means he was so, drunk or high or whatever, that he could fall into the water and not wake up immediately. But whatever. When he gets out of the hospital, he still seems pretty shaky, and his siblings are not sure how to talk to him or about him, as Roman jokes to Comfrey, who was apparently the one who found him in the pool, that if such a thing happens again, she should just let him drown.
Now, what was your interpretation of how long? My interpretation of this is basically the next day, basically, right? Is this kind of...
That we're seeing them the day after? Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So yes. It's like one day has passed since the events of last episode. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Or, yeah, more or less. But in terms of letting him drown, Kendall himself might say the same thing based on what we see later in the episode. It's dark times for him.
Indeed. Yeah.
Back to the deal. The DOJ is planning to levy a fine of historic proportions on Waystar, and Gojo's market cap has officially overtaken Waystar's.
Yeah. So this whole Gojo Waystar merger is kind of interesting. I think the parallels I can think of, right, in real life are the Fox Disney merger, the Universal Comcast, but Fox and Disney were both kind of content production companies. Disney was into theme parks or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, the way in which they're talking about the deal feels a lot closer to AT&T, HBO, or Universal Comcast, where it's basically a tech company and a content company, right?
Like, well, AOL Time Warner was before any of those two.
Yeah, no, great reference as well. Yeah, so there are many kind of parallels to this in real life, and I just wanted to call out that often in these situations, it's unclear who is eating who sometimes.
Right. So Logan brings Roman with him to talk to Mattson about the deal, and though Jerry also seems to be alive professionally, Logan does take the quiet moment of travel to try and figure out what Roman's deal is sexually, which is what we all want to know, and asks, you know, are you scared of women? That's not the term he uses, but that's what he means. And Roman tries to laugh it off, but Logan says that if Roman needs to straighten himself out, he should. And Logan does not want to know about it, which shades of checking in with Kendall after the drowning death of the waiter to be like, you're fine, right? Great. Let's not talk about it anymore.
Yeah. What did you think he meant by like straighten yourself out? Like go to like a Christian deprogramming camp or something like that? Like,
I just think he meant whatever you're doing, don't let it be in public again.
Yeah, yeah, fair enough. So what happens with Mattson?
Well, so they get to Mattson's place and Mattson is basically like, I'll buy you and then I will be the new CEO. Right?
Yeah. And it's an offer that as far as we understand, Logan would never take, right? And in fact, Mattson even acknowledges this, like he's like, you probably want to tell me to fuck off. I think he says something like this slab of Gravlax, is what he calls it?
Yes, so, yes.
Yeah, and I was actually shocked that Logan was entertaining it,
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Well, especially with Roman there, because Roman seems to think this is a preposterous idea. And then as they keep talking, Mattson's like, well, what about this other thing? It's like something about Israel or whatever. The details aren't important.
Machine learning AI company in Israel that's been referenced a few times this season. Yeah.
Right. So Logan's like, yeah, let's talk about that. Well, Roman, you should get home now. And Roman knows what this means.
Run along now.
Yeah. And another reminder of how much Roman wants to keep his status as Logan's number one boy, particularly after the scandalous events of the last episode, is that he doesn't tell Shiv about getting kicked out of the meeting or what was said before he was released.
Yeah. Always trying to save face, Roman is. Yeah.
Yeah. So then there's also Kendall gets summoned to a breakfast with his siblings so that they can try and fail to assure Kendall that they all love him, and he is immediately suspicious, thinks it's an intervention, tries to tell all of them they need an intervention more than he does. And the way this goes is why they had a therapist at Connor's Ranch back in that season one episode. Like, none of them knows how to be honest or sincere. They also might not be honest or sincere when they tell Kendall that they hope he doesn't die.
Yeah. And you kind of know right from the outset, like, this is going to go badly because,
mm-hmm.
Roman says, we're all here to tell you that we love you, and
yeah.
Roman has never been able to express an earnest thought in his whole entire life. We've never seen him do so on the show, pretty much, maybe with Jerry once or twice. But
mm-hmm.
you just know something's going to spin out of control. And in fact, it does. Right.
Yes, it does. And one of the things that happens is that Kendall gets morose about being the eldest son and having his legacy taken from him that he was expecting to get. And Connor at first quietly and then quite loudly is like, I'm the eldest son. And he's furious about being usurped and disregarded. I mean, it starts before Kendall even gets there when he hears that this Mattson deal is even happening, because he says Mattson wants to deplatform maverick thinkers like Connor, blah, 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 blah. But it ends up spinning out into something more, more intense and deeper than they seem to have expected or heard him say before.
We've talked in previous episodes about how the show doesn't really know what to do with Connor, and this season that's been fairly obvious.
Yeah.
But I did really appreciate the scene.
I did too.
I think that in this scene, you kind of get a glimpse of what it has been like for Connor to have been overlooked his entire life. Not even overlooked, like barely even acknowledged.
Yes.
Right? And you sense the anger and resentment that comes from that. And I thought Alan Ruck did a great job bringing that out. So even though I think the Connor storyline has kind of fizzled out this season along with the Kendall storyline, I think that his anger in this scene felt real to me in a way that the show has done a good job of building up to. So
yeah. They also give us more detail than I think we knew in this scene, too, where at one point when he's just listing all of his, you know, grievances, he says, I didn't see Dad for 3 years. And presumably this is after his mother got divorced from Logan.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't feel like that's something we had ever heard before.
Yeah, I think that's right.
That plus this camping trip that keeps getting brought up, like what was happening in those years?
It's great. They give you these little glimpses, but they don't necessarily need to spell it all out. So I like that kind of storytelling. So.
I agree. And it's enough. Yes. We don't need a flashback episode where we see what happens. I'm just saying, like,
backdoor pilot this camping trip for us.
Yeah, no, I just meant like it tells us how it sketches out these pivotal moments without, you know, needing to get into a huge amount of detail where it's like, oh, okay, this is like another piece of the puzzle of how these people became the way they are.
Yeah, totally, totally.
But Connor is still so mad in the next scene that finally Willa, perhaps to just make him feel better, decides to accept his marriage proposal. And what she actually says is, fuck it. Come on. How bad can it be? Right. And then he's really happy and she regrets it immediately.
Well, so where did you get that she regrets it immediately? Like, how are you picking up on that?
She, when she got in the car, they made sure to stay on her face and her face fell. She was not happy.
Yeah.
When they get to the wedding, she starts sobbing immediately.
Oh, yeah.
And she's drinking. They show her drinking a lot.
That was amazing when there's like a quick, like literally like a 1 second shot of her drinking so much that she's spilling on herself, I think.
Yeah.
So just amazing kind of whip pan from Willa to, you know, the rest of the kids. So,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, sex work is hard. You know, you're supposed to say yes to the client, but sometimes some yeses are harder than others.
Indeed. So what else happens this episode?
So, we've already said the wedding happens and we actually see some of it, which that was new and that was not what we were expecting either, I think we said last week. But Carl and Frank arrive in Europe along with a whole detachment of lawyers and stuff carrying boxes, and they all get set up in some castle or villa or whatever somewhere. So whatever is going on, it means Logan misses the wedding. We see Marcia for a second saying, I guess I'll give them your regrets. And outside of the wedding, Peter is just like standing there waiting for Logan to show up so that he can start like kissing up to him again. But
yeah,
Caroline tells him, I'm sorry, you're going to have to content yourself with me. She's an awful character, but she is very funny. They give her some great lines.
Agreed. She's awesome. Yeah.
At the reception, Connor also shows Shiv and Roman one of the like roots or plants or something that Carrie has been putting in Logan's smoothies, and says that you only take whatever this is if you're trying to supercharge your semen, basically. So his suggestion is Logan is going to try and get Carrie pregnant with another generation of Roy's because he thinks that Kendall and Shiv and Roman aren't shit, basically.
Do you buy this theory?
I don't.
Really? Interesting. I think it's at least plausible because the episode spent so much time focusing on that shake that she gives him in that room.
That's
true. This big shot where she walks in and then she hands him this drink that looks weird. Mm-hmm. Looks, it's like brown. It's not like a glass of water or anything.
Oh, it's no, it's yes. It's some kind of green juice. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's like, why would they show that unless this was actually, there's some truth to this? That was kind of my conclusion.
Well, they showed the smoothie first and then they had him say what was in it. So I assumed that was so that they could establish the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, anything is possible. I don't see Logan wanting to have more kids.
I don't know. But here's something else.
He won't be around to see them like either succeed or fail. He's going to die.
Yeah. But, you know, maybe he's like, maybe he knew what was going to happen this episode and he's like, I got to start from scratch.
Yeah.
Also, we haven't commented on the lavish production values and like the place where this reception is held. It looks incredible. And there's that big tilting shot where you see, I think, where the church is and then it goes mm-hmm. all the way down to there. It's just like, mind-blowing. I've never
it's
seen
it's very
like
beautiful
this before, right?
Yes, it's lovely.
So yeah, they did a good job with the budget that they had. So
yeah, as usual, they picked some nice shots for these people to be having their events in.
Agreed.
Nice
Agreed.
Locations. So at the reception, this talk about the smoothie and Logan's possible next round of kids goes straight into speculation about various financiers being in town. And Shiv and Roman decide they have to involve Kendall in a counterattack on whatever is happening. And although Kendall had said earlier in the episode that he was talking to new lawyers and planning to put all of his like papers and communications and stuff on Instagram, the fire to continue trying to attack Logan has gone out of him. And he sadly says he feels disconnected from his kids. His life is not going the way he wanted it to. He thought there was an out for all of them. And then just finally blurts, I killed a kid. And he also says they are going to come for him. I don't know who he thinks they are or if this is just more like paranoid ideation. But Shiv and Roman are shocked at first, but they recover very, very quickly to joke about it.
I mean, here's the thing. I was disappointed that they did not kill Kendall. Because per the conversation we had last week, it really feels like they have nowhere to go with this character anymore, right? Like
with Kendall, yeah.
With Kendall as a character. Mm-hmm. I don't know where else interesting you can explore. There was a path where he like gets out of the company, right? And
yeah.
And I guess that's going to happen anyway, you know, involuntarily.
Right.
But, and he'll Spoiler. Probably do just fine based off of it, you know?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
But I don't, the character has kind of served his purpose in the narrative, and he's had an amazing arc, a 3-season arc, and it was like, would have been a bold and beautiful decision to kill him off at the end of the last episode. And the show did not do that. And I think that is ultimately, I think that will prove to be a wrong decision from a storytelling perspective. We will see if I'm right or wrong about that. Well, the show has maybe one or two more seasons to go.
Right.
But in this scene, we see what the fruits of that New Yorker profile was talking about in terms of his process. I think it's an incredible piece of acting by Jeremy Strong. I really thought it was well done and also gives us something that we have been wanting the show to reckon with since season one, which is him killing this kid.
Right.
Or manslaughtering this kid more accurately.
Yes.
And so I, on the one hand, I'm disappointed that they did not kill off his character, but they did give us some quasi payoff for this thing that's been hanging over him since season one.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that we've seen the end of the reckoning for that, but I am glad that we are starting to see it in this episode.
Yeah.
So anyway, your thoughts on this scene?
I agree that his performance is great. I don't necessarily agree that he needs to go through the, you know, all of the nonsense that he does to get there. But I mean, the results are undeniable. Yes, I'm just saying, like, you know, Kieran Culkin is also great in this scene, and from what we heard or
and he's
learned,
not treating his colleagues in a way that's objectionable to them, for example.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. But I agree. Like, I don't necessarily think it was a wrong decision to not kill Kendall. I mean, again, as I said, I don't think his having his children or whatever find him in that way would have, whatever. I guess there was a way that they could have got around it. But I also think there's more depth for Kendall to plumb, by which I mean I don't think the show is done making him suffer yet.
All right, fair enough.
The Sweet Smell of Succession is brought to you in part by Warby Parker. Warby Parker was founded with a rebellious spirit and a lofty goal to create boutique quality eyewear at a revolutionary price point. Offering eyeglasses, sunglasses, contact lenses, and eye exams, Warby Parker is committed to providing exceptional vision care online and in stores. My eyeglass prescription just changed, and instead of replacing the lenses in my old frames, I decided to pick out some new ones from Warby Parker. I selected three styles to be sent to me in Warby Parker's home try-on kit, but when the package arrived, they had added a couple more from the same category recommended for my face shape, and you know what? Warby Parker was right, and I ended up going with one of their picks. Selecting the style I wanted and sending back the samples was so easy. My finished pair with my new blue light filtering prescription lenses arrived at my door less than a week later, and I couldn't be happier with them. If you prefer shopping in stores, Warby Parker also has retail locations throughout the U.S. You can find your nearest store at warbyparker.com/succession. Glasses start at 95%, including prescription lenses. Try Warby Parker's free home try-on program. Order 5 pairs of glasses to try at home for free for 5 days. There's no obligation to buy. Ships free and includes a prepaid return shipping label. Don't let your FSA or HSA dollars go to waste. Put them to good use on Warby Parker prescription glasses, prescription sunglasses, contact lenses, and eye exams. Try 5 pairs of glasses at home for free at warbyparker.com/succession.
I'm seeing a lot of action on my Twitter timeline about many of the shots in this episode. And there's this shot in this episode where Kendall's on the ground and Roman is standing over him with his hands on each shoulder. And then like Shiv's kind of touching Roman on the shoulder. And it's kind of a somewhat mirror image of one of the last shots of the episode where it's Roman that's on the ground. Kendall is trying to comfort Roman and Shiv standing next to them. Right. Mm-hmm. And so there's just a really great mirroring from a blocking and staging perspective that happens in this episode.
Yeah.
Another thing I just saw pop up on the timeline was, I don't know if you remember the poster of the season, but it shows kind of all of the Roys walking down a hallway.
Yeah.
And Isaac Feldberg tweeted out, they told us this was coming right from the start.
Yeah.
And he in his tweet, he has a little image of the poster, and you see a line that divides the two parties, and on one side is Logan, Greg, and Tom, and on the other side is the rest of the Roys. And so it does seem like it is a foreshadowing of what's going to happen at the end of this episode.
Yeah.
So just wanted to point those things out in terms of like blocking and staging that are kind of relevant here. Anyway, any more thoughts on this scene? I think it was a great scene, and the only downside to the scene is something you point out later in the show notes, start to steal your thunder, but how quickly it's over and they move on to the next thing, right?
Yeah, yes. Well, I mean, the last button I'll put on this is that no one in this scene says no real person involved, which was the chilling abbreviation that used to be used on cruises when something awful would happen to somebody who wasn't a guest, an RPI. But that seems to be Shiv and Roman's feeling about what happened. Like when they hear the details of Kendall tells them what happens and tells them truthfully, like exactly how it went down. Roman's like, well, this sounds like you sound like a hero to me. If it was me, I would have just left. I wouldn't have tried to dive down or what, you know, it just goes on that way.
I thought it was a lovely moment. I know it's chilling. It's chilling because of the terrifying implications of it. But the idea of it is like Roman's basically going to wear him down with his like, you know, humor and stuff. And he slowly does in the course of the scene. And anyway, it was, even though they're talking about the manslaughter of a child, of a, you know, young person, I thought it was kind of this lovely moment of like Roman expressing his love to Kendall in the only way that he knew how, which
I
is
agree
through,
that
through jokes. Through
I
jokes.
Agree. Yeah. I don't know that I would say it was lovely.
Yeah.
But
fair.
It would have also felt off tone if they had reacted in a normal human way.
Right.
But ultimately, like this arc for Kendall is not only that this waiter will, you know, never be avenged or there won't be justice for what happened to him or whatever, but also that Kendall, there's no path for him to heal from this or to like forgive himself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, should he forgive himself is the wrong way to do it. But like for him to come to terms with this and be able to move on, because it's just like, you know, this dark thing that got fixed for him by his dad, you know, and this is the tragedy. Other than the person died, it's also that, like, he doesn't know, there's no way for him to expiate his guilt, basically.
There is no redemption for him to be found.
Yes.
And even in confessing to his siblings, you know, Shiv is on the phone with Laird. She's like, "Hey, sorry, got to take this business call. Earnest confession. I got to put this on hold for a second. Got to take care of some business here." You know, like, and then Roman's like joking around. It's like, even in this confession, he doesn't have any absolution of any kind.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that's a great point. So.
All right. Well, you've kind of tipped it already, but what happens from this is after Shiv gets confirmation from Laird about what the deal is going to be and how it's going to be bad for them, they decide the three kids decide they need to depose Logan and divide up the spoils, basically. And the way that this is going to work is that they're going to go and confront him and say they don't want him to do it. And they'll have him save face by claiming he's, you know, stepping down from the company for health reasons. And fortunately for them, and we already heard a little bit about this in the last episode, too, it came up that that when Caroline and Logan got divorced, she helped arrange for a holding company to exist that would give them more control over the company.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not going to get into the nitty gritty because I'm not a lawyer, and these are always the parts of the show that I understand / care about the least. But basically, they have the power to keep Logan from having a board supermajority and pushing through this sale.
Right. And it's dependent on this thing that Logan's ex-wife has control of, basically.
Correct.
Right. Yeah.
Yes.
So, yeah.
And I realize some of this is just Roy's on autopilot, but I don't buy Kendall bouncing back this fast from this admission that he has spent two seasons trying not to make.
I would agree with you. I think it's a little bit rushed, and not only that, but like it's the exact same dynamic we saw in season one, episode six, you know, where they go to the board meeting and it's like, and Roman has the ability to kill Logan right there, and he doesn't take it, right?
Yes.
So for this scene and the ensuing events take place, you need to believe that Kendall would believe that Roman has changed in some way, right?
Right.
And I don't know that the show does enough to make you feel that that's true. You know, mm-hmm. It doesn't do nothing, but like basically Roman has stabbed Kendall in the back viciously in the past.
And they both have.
Yeah, they all have. Yeah, everyone has. And so would Kendall, after having been stabbed in the back viciously by both of these characters, then confessing this thing that they haven't really taken that seriously.
Yes.
Then be like, okay, let's, you know, saddle up and let's go. You know, like, I don't know. It beggars belief a little bit. And so I agree with you that it does strain credulity a little bit. Right?
Yeah. I mean, I guess this is the one thing where like one more episode would have been beneficial.
Yeah.
But I mean, to go back to what we were saying before, if we had seen, you know, a big emotional reckoning with these three characters, we wouldn't have bought that either. So, you know, there are things that need to happen. So they happened. And that's how TV works.
Indeed.
Anyway, so then while they're driving over, everyone's making calls to just shore up their positions, including Shiv calling Tom and saying, you know, we're going to get him to step down for health reasons and ATN will report it. And so Tom is saying, we can use you as confirming sources. She says yes. He hangs up. Greg comes over to talk some kind of bullshit, which we'll get to in the in the other stuff section of this episode.
Yeah.
But basically is like, something's coming. Do you want to come with me? And Greg is sort of mealy-mouthed like, well, I've got Bright Star Buffalo in my back pocket. But Tom's like, come with me. You can rise to the bottom of the top.
From the endless middle. The bottom of the top, which I thought was a great, great, you know, turn of phrase. Yeah.
Yes. And Greg is like, could I have my own Greg? And Tom says, you can have 20 Gregs. And Greg says, you know, do you want to make a deal with the devil? And Greg says, who needs a soul anyway? Souls are boring. Directly to the viewers who think that Greg is the norm of the satire. He is not. He's just as bad as everyone else, as I've been saying. He's just as venal.
Putting that aside, I think this scene is pretty awesome because when you're watching it the first time, you have one reading of it, which is, oh, Tom's about to, again, saddle up and do another thing for his wife. You know, like that's what he's going to do.
Right.
But then watching it again, he's contemplating stabbing Shiv in the back. And also people pointed out people on Twitter pointed out that earlier on this season, Tom tells the story of Nero and Sporus.
Right.
Nero pushed his wife down the stairs, and then he had Sporus castrated and he married him instead.
He sure did.
And Tom kind of metaphorically pushes his wife down the stairs in this one.
He
kind of metaphorically marries Greg in this one. You know,
he does.
It's all paying off. It's all paying off. Anyway, we'll get to it. We'll get to the Tom stuff. But yeah.
Well, they shake on it and then they hug on it. Yeah. So it's, you know, there's more emotion here than there is between the Roy siblings that are, you know, dealing with a dead waiter.
Agreed.
So the kids get to this whatever Logan's posted up to do all his businessing and confront him. And Logan is very calm and not shocked that they are there, by the way, and just says, it's the best moment to sell. And they want to know, you know, what they're all supposed to do after Logan puts his $5 billion from the sale on the pile with all of his other billions. And he says, make your own billions, which, good point. And Shiv says, without you, we're fucked. And I would just say, not to take any Roy's side against any others, because they should all go jump in a lake. But this is kind of probably the whole issue for Logan as well. Ma'am, like, if you're saying I'm fucked without the protection of my daddy at this company, like, maybe you don't deserve to have a job. Just saying.
Well, there is this, like, there is an amazing line earlier when Madsen says, oh, I'm willing to evaluate each one according to their abilities.
Right.
You know, which is, I think, something that all the Roy children are deathly afraid of, being evaluated fairly by their abilities.
Yeah.
I mean, I do think even if they were skilled, they would probably still be fucked, but also they have shown themselves to be fairly unskilled throughout.
This is a thing that happens whenever there's any merger, like whether there's families involved or not, and usually there isn't. Like, you know, if there's going to be duplication between who does what job, you know, the people that are in the smaller, less powerful position are obviously going to be more vulnerable. But in this particular case, if their whole thing is like, this is our legacy, like, no one cares about that.
Yeah.
that's been the point of the show since the start. Like, do any of you deserve what you think you are owed? And maybe not.
Agreed. So, and this whole scene takes like a long time. It feels like it's like 10, 15 minutes to unfold.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of beats and a lot of moments that need to be hit by the actors and then reflected on screen. And overall, I thought they did a really good job. But what else happens in the scene?
Well, so they're getting ready to pull their trump card. And Logan just says they're playing toy fucking soldiers. And he already has them beat because remember that prenup? Turns out he and Logan opened it up and Caroline sold out the holding company in exchange for Logan helping Peter get a leg up in his political career.
Indeed.
As Shiv puts it, Caroline just cut their throats. Yeah. And they're all so shocked. All Roman can do is just say, Dad, please. And Logan is furious and asks what Roman is even offering in exchange for consideration. And Roman is like, fucking love. And Logan, not wrongly, scoffs at how empty a claim that is given the circumstances in which they all entered, ready to, as they put it on the drive over, kill Logan. And he says, you should have trusted me. I fucking win. And Tom said it in What It Takes, and he was right.
So a few things about this whole thing. First of all, I think Brian Cox is just incredible here. Mm-hmm. And when he's reacting to the characters at first, you know, he's obviously very belligerent and obviously very like steamrolling. And the problem is he is that way whether or not he's holding the royal flush. You know? And so it is completely indistinguishable whether he actually has the jump on these people or he doesn't.
Yeah.
And so they're interpreting, you know, she's like, don't trust him. You can't trust him. You know, Shiv says you can't trust him. And she's in general right because he has screwed each of them over in various ways. And he would be behaving this way even if he didn't have anything, even if he wasn't holding anything in his hand.
Yeah.
And so I'm watching the scene and I'm interpreting it like, oh, yeah, Logan is just being his normal self. But then when it comes out that he has them beat and he's revealing it, then it's like, oh, like it all kind of snaps into place and it recontextualizes everything that Logan has done before then.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing moment when he says toy fucking soldiers. Like he's like, it's just like, wow. Like he already, they were dead to rights from the moment he walked in.
Yeah. Now,
the other thing about this that is just absolutely heartbreaking is him talking to Roman and being like, hey, like Roman, let's talk about this separately. Like you have a place in this world. And I,
which
actually,
is true.
Madsen, I actually believe him, right? Because that's set up from the earlier Madsen talk, right?
Madsen says, said it. Yes.
And I believe Madsen too. You know, Madsen says like, you know, Roman would be integral to this whole process. And you know that Madsen and Roman have like, are simpatico.
Yes.
And so it is highly plausible that Roman, if he had actually betrayed Kendall in this moment, could have actually benefited, unlike previous times when he's betrayed Kendall.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what makes it so heartbreaking, is because he has finally, like, this is the first moment. There's a post-episode featurette on HBO Max where the creators of the show say this is like kind of the first moment where the three kids are finally united for the very first time, right?
Yeah.
They don't want to lose their legacy.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going in kind of as a united front. And there's this amazing moment when like Roman has to say like, hey, I actually think Kendall should stay in the room. You know, like Logan says, Kendall should leave. I don't trust him. And Roman's like, you know what? I think it'd be better if all of us here. And you can see him like slowly building up to finally standing up to his dad.
Yeah.
And then when he finally does, it is when it is the most useless time to do that.
Right.
And I got to say, my heart kind of broke for Roman just a little bit, just a little bit. I think it's Shakespearean, you know, this whole idea of like they finally at last banded together. And in that moment, they had nothing on him. And it was, it's upsetting. It's upsetting to watch. So
just like J. Smith Cameron said.
Indeed.
Who, by the way, she and Carl and Frank are all in the room while this is going on, and the camera never cuts to them for reactions.
I know.
Like you forget they're there. Until
it's amazing. Yeah, it's an amazing kind of decision to have them there. Like they didn't have to be there, you know, for the scene. But anyway, what are the other things that happen in this scene, Tara?
So as when they figure out that Caroline has cut this deal with Logan, they realize someone told Logan they were coming and made him do this.
Yeah.
Because he didn't want to help Peter. He hated Peter. He wouldn't even shake his hand in the last episode. But, you know, he needed this leverage. Roman goes to Jerry to ask, essentially, like, hey, can you speak up for us? And she just quietly says she's focused on serving the shareholders and this deal is what will.
And again, another heartbreaking moment because it's about what's not being said between the two of them. Like the two of them cannot really communicate, certainly not in this crowd, what they really feel. And, you know, Jerry has been let down by Roman, right?
Mm-hmm.
Roman has demonstrated to Jerry he is unreliable. He can't be trusted to be professional.
Yeah.
As we saw last episode. And put Jerry totally in jeopardy.
That's
last episode, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe if Roman had played his cards right, maybe if Roman was a different person, if Roman did not listen to his nature, things might have played out differently. Maybe Jerry could have even been on his side here. But because he didn't, she says, like, you know, what's in it for my personal interest, which I think it echoes a line she said earlier on this season to him about like what you always have to be looking out for, something like
that. Yes. Well, and she's gotten where she is by avoiding mess, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And so, yeah, it's a absolutely heartbreaking moment because Roman's basically like kind of begging for his life and getting turned down by Jerry, like who's theoretically one of the only people that can save him.
Right.
So, yeah, brutal moment. So.
And then Tom is out in the hall.
Huh. Tom's there.
Shiv sees him get a nice clap on the shoulder from Logan as Logan walks past him. And she realizes who sold them out. And we should link to an article that Catherine Van Arendonk wrote at Vulture after Too Much Birthday, speculating about how the season is going to hinge on Tom having had enough. And she was right.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm curious, Tara, like, did you, First of all, I just want to admire the economy of the words in this whole sequence where, mm-hmm. you know, Shiv has this moment like, who told Logan we were coming or something along those lines, right? And yeah. like, you need to, as the viewer, you need to get in that moment like somebody betrayed them.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And then in the scene afterwards, you need to get like, it was Tom. Mm-hmm. And then in the scene after, you need to get like, maybe Shiv recognizes that. I thought it was ambiguous personally, but I'm not, you know, I don't know. I don't know if Shiv got it at the end. What do you think?
Yes, of course she did. Yeah.
Because I guess when you're looking at Tom, it's showing it from Shiv's perspective, theoretically.
Yes.
Like the camera angle looking at Tom. And then Tom comes in and is like, are you okay? And she's like, yeah, I'm completely fine. You know, like still putting on that front, even though she's been completely decimated.
Yeah. Well, she can't be weak with him.
Yeah.
Now she knows he's an adversary.
Yeah, that's a fair point. So, and... I mean, when this moment happened, I guess I'm curious, like, how did you feel about it? Do you feel like this was a good payoff, good setup and payoff? Like, did you feel like the show delivered on the Tom storyline?
Yes. 100%. I mean, I felt like after what happened in the season 2 finale, where he just sort of said, I don't know if I would be... If I would be more, I won't remember the quote exactly, but everyone knows what it was, where he's like, I don't know if the sad I would be without you is worse than the sad I am with you, yeah. Something to that effect. That it seemed like then they were in crisis mode and he was just like going along to get along. And then now we find out like he does have a breaking point and he reached it and he broke her.
I think we have seen Shiv treat Tom with nothing but contempt this season.
Yeah.
We talked a little bit about the pre-sex talk they had mm-hmm. last episode and how chilling and brutal and upsetting it was.
Yeah.
But there's also the scene this episode where Shiv's on the phone giving Tom orders, which is something that happens a lot this season.
Mm-hmm.
And last season, I think, if I recall correctly. No, wait.
Yeah.
Yeah, last season too, yeah. And so Tom at this point has had like 2.5 seasons of abuse at Shiv's hands, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so he's probably fed up with it, but there's this moment in this episode where, you know, Shiv is negotiating like what's going on and he's like, here's how it's going to play out. And then Tom's like, and what about me? What's going to happen to me in this scenario? And she's like, oh, you know, I don't know. We're going to like find you a place high up. And it is the standard kind of completely thoughtless response. Like Shiv clearly has put zero thought into it and doesn't give a shit. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And shortly after that, we see Tom kind of staring pensively into the distance.
Yeah.
And he's contemplating kind of that call, I think, and like where he would end up in the Shiv empire. And
yeah,
I honestly feel like if Shiv had treated that conversation differently in the car, like mm-hmm. it might have been a different outcome, you know?
Yeah.
If she had put some thought into how it played out for Tom, he might have played it differently. So
maybe.
Here's a question. Why do you think Tom needed Greg? You know, in the earlier scene, he says, like, I kind of might need a attack dog, a Greg Weiler. And I guess I'm curious, like, why would Tom need Greg in the scenario where he's, like, betraying Shiv and telling, you know, Logan and his ex-wife about the betrayal? Do you have any thoughts on that, or?
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe just moral support?
Maybe? Yeah, I think he wants someone in his own corner. Yeah. And... that was maybe a way of dressing it up, like, I will protect you from your cousins. You know?
Yeah.
That he's giving cover to that. I guess we'll see.
I do want to say that the final shot of the episode I thought was really masterful. You know, it ends on this shot of Tom and Shiv. And
yeah.
And Shiv is just... her world has been completely upended, and Tom is kind of, like, trying to comfort her in that moment, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's a level of heightened emotion place to end an episode, and I just thought it was it's just an amazing final shot of the season. So, yeah. So there are many things I liked about the episode, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But let's talk about some of the things I didn't like, Tara.
Okay.
You have an other stuff section here on the show notes.
Just a few.
Take us through some other stuff that happened.
There's just a couple other things. I just noticed that Hiam Abbas, who plays Marsha, is now busted down to guest starring. Mm. So I guess we shouldn't
expect
to see
like
a lot more Marsha.
She used to be in the opening credits as a...
I believe she was first because they were in alphabetical order.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now she guests. I think the Marsha storyline has been woefully underserved this episode, this yeah. season, right? Like,
yes.
You thought that it was setting her up to be like kind of a big player this season.
Yeah.
And then she just seems to be almost completely jettisoned. Like, she has essentially no role mm-hmm. in the latter half of the season.
Yeah.
So kind of a bummer. Kind of a bummer that one is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what else is in your other stuff category, Tara?
We also, early in the episode, get the adult children playing Monopoly, which was, and cheating at Monopoly, of course, and that was really on the nose, I felt.
Yes. Yes. It was a very obvious choice. Not very subtle symbology there.
No.
With the Roy children playing Monopoly, yeah.
And finally, I just want to mention that Greg pursuing this princess or contessa or whatever and possibly, you know, ending up in line for the throne of Luxembourg, him, her, Comfrey. I don't know what this is innate of, but I sure did not care.
I think the Greg storyline has like completely jumped the shark at this point. Like, it's actually a staggering miscalculation, in my opinion. Like,
yeah,
it feels the whole time we're focusing on Greg and this contessa, which is like wildly implausible, by the way. I'm like, what? Why are we paying any attention to this as opposed to all the other stuff we should be like wrapping up this episode? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I thought the Greg stuff, there's a nice moment with Tom. I really like that. But the other stuff with Greg, I just thought was a total waste of time. And I am curious how the show is going to handle Greg next season. And actually, on that note, I guess I'm curious, like, if you have any kind of thoughts or predictions of what you would want to see as the dynamic for next season, right?
Like, I mean, I just hope they give him something useful to do. If they're going to keep him in the mix, like, give him a purpose for being there.
I think his arc from kind of, you know, naive, innocent dude to conniving, venal dude was pretty well done. But it was a sort of arc that felt like it had completed at the end of season one.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
And so I'm not sure what else they're going to do with Greg, but whatever they're going to do, this ain't it, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think they should pursue this path.
Yeah.
I think there could be a lot of interesting dynamics for next season, right?
Yeah.
Specifically, you have potentially Madsen in charge, and then Logan still in the background, and then Tom potentially as like a top lieutenant in whatever Roy Star Jojo or Gojo organization is left after this.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be interesting. I think that could be interesting. And then seeing the other kids like go up against that or deal with that, that could be interesting. What I am worried about is some scenario like what we got at the beginning of this season, where the next episode begins minutes after this one ends.
Right.
And it's like, it's all about the kids trying to like undo what happened in this episode, basically.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I am worried about that. I hope that they use this as an opportunity to completely reset the status quo and give us a completely different dynamic between all the characters next season. I think that would genuinely be interesting. So that's what I'm hoping for. Yeah. Let's wrap it up. But before we do that, Tara, do you want to give a plug for where else people can find you if they're enjoying your scintillating recaps and our dialogue?
Sure. You can also read my written recaps of this very show, Succession, at decider.com. And you can hear my other podcasts, again with this, about Melrose Place, Listen to Sassy about Sassy Magazine, and Extra Hot Great about all things television on any of your podcast platforms.
Check out my other podcasts, Culturally Relevant at culturallyrelevantshow.com, wherever podcasts can be downloaded, and also The Filmcast, where I talk about movies every week, at thefilmcast.com. We hope you've enjoyed chatting about Succession with us this season, and that you'll follow us to the other stuff that we do online, because we do a lot of it, and we do it all year. So thanks for listening, and of course follow us on Twitter to get the latest on what we're up to. Every week we choose a winning Roy, a losing Roy, a winning non-Roy, a losing non-Roy, and then we give a quote of the week. Tara, I think we agree on most of these this week, right?
Winning Roy is
of course Logan.
Of course he won.
He fucking won.
Yep.
He dominated everyone. Not even close.
Indeed.
Losing Roy, I was gonna list all of the children Roys, but I think one clearly rises to the top. Who is that?
Yeah, Roman was the closest to winning and then lost.
Yeah, so brutal fall from grace for Roman, and so for that reason he is the losing Roy this week. Winning non-Roy, pretty obvious, Lucas Madsen, right? He's probably going to be in charge of the whole kit and caboodle.
Correct.
And so he is the winning non-Roy. Losing non-Roy. Who's the losing non-Roy for you, Tara?
I mean, this is tough because, like, maybe it's hard to say. I had somehow the waiter again from the season one finale is yet again being trotted out to be a victim of the Roy's nefarious doings.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to say Comfrey because she's about to be rejected from Greg, I think, which is probably one of the saddest fates I can think of for a character. So it's one thing to be rejected in general. It's another thing to be rejected by Greg. That, like, you know, Arrested Development voice him.
Sure. Kind
of, yeah.
But this way she doesn't have to date him, and that's probably better off.
Oh, yeah. You're right. Didn't think about it like that. Okay. Each week we choose a quote of the week. Your quote of the week, Tara?
Finally, Kendall saying, in so many words, after protesting the opposite this entire season, I'm not a good person.
Indeed. And there were many, many good quotes in this episode that I appreciated, like, you know what? Fuck it. Come on, how bad it can be. Or
yeah.
I'd be happy to assess each according to their abilities. Or Tom saying, you know, Greg, if you off a couple of hemophiliacs, like, you might be, you know, in line for the throne. Mm-hmm. But I do love a good Logan Roy inserting the word fuck in there, and Hans Christian Anderfuck, mm-hmm. I thought was pretty sharp, pretty sharp, pretty evocative.
Yeah.
Which is what the show does well. All right. I think that is going to bring us to the end of this week's episode and our last episode of the season. Thank you for listening. Tara, thanks for chatting with me about the show. It's been an honor and a pleasure. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, David.
And until next time, we'll see you. Is there going to be another season? Who knows when the next season will be or what our lives will be like at that point? The best I can do is be sure to follow us on Twitter at Dave Chensky, at Tara Ariano, and also subscribe to this feed. And we'll probably post an episode if we're going to be doing a new season. So stick around and we'll let you know more when the time is right. All right, folks. Thanks. Be safe out there. We'll see you around.
Bye.